All right. Thank you very much, Ed and Stephanie. I want to reiterate where we started a little bit on this. And the work out of GAO that Stephanie talked about came to them from Congress. They were being approached by folks who were saying, you know what, you really need to be committed to this top tier, this randomized controlled trials. And I'm sure they had a very in-depth conversation with those staffers on the Hill and so on. But unfortunately, a lot of folks in those kind of positions, non-specialists, policymakers, decision makers, they only bring away certain takeaway messages from conversations like that. And that takeaway message might just be randomized control trial good, everything else bad. Okay, so some of those messages that folks may walk away with can be really detrimental for us. Because as we just saw, as Ed, I think, very well demonstrated, that there's a progression, what he called a building block model, towards building evidence and towards even getting to the point where it would make any sense to try to attempt an RCT or some of these most rigorous designs. So I want to talk to you a little bit about an initiative that we've launched out of the Office of Justice Programs. A little over a year ago, our new Assistant Attorney General, Lori Robinson, came into her position, and she had 10 major goals for the Office of Justice Programs. And those goals, two of them included a real emphasis on, one of them was a real emphasis on science, and the focus on science has been articulated from the President through the Attorney General on down to the Office of Justice Programs. And one of those goals was really to focus on data-driven strategies and evidence-based practices. And we took a look inside our organization to really figure how should we approach this. And through a fairly extensive process of talking with folks from across our organization, we developed what we call our Evidence Integration Initiative. And I've got the three primary goals of that initiative up on the board. Essentially, we're looking to improve the quality and quantity of evidence that we generate, looking to improve the management of knowledge and the integration of evidence to inform program and policy decisions, and really looking to improve the translation of evidence into practice. Now, there's a number of goals under these, a number of objectives under these goals and a variety of activities that we're going forward with. But I'm going to focus on a couple of pieces of this that speak to this question of generating evidence and also the goal two here, managing and synthesizing and integrating evidence and knowledge. Because what we found is that, you know, at the Office of Justice Programs, we're not the office of replicating evidence-based programs. Okay, so we don't just fund a list of programs, go replicate these things. We fund a lot of innovation, and we put out a lot of flexible funding streams that allows the state and local professionals to really determine how best to address their needs. Criminal and juvenile justice are fields where there's a lot of local innovation. In fact, that's where most of our innovation. And it's not much of this innovation doesn't come about through people who consider themselves program developers necessarily. They're simply people trying to solve problems at the local level. And they're professionals who have a lot of training and experience, but it may not be in research. What we need to recognize is that our approach to addressing evidence should be cognizant of the fact that what we're trying to do is inform decision-making and get folks who are in those decision-making positions to integrate evidence into their process. And so therefore it has to be helpful for them. It can't paint them into a box, and it can't make them feel like their options are extremely limited. So I want to talk a little bit, to start off, with some of our evidence generation piece and say right out of the gate that we're very committed to increasing our commitment to randomized controlled trials and randomized designs. For the reasons that we've already discussed, that I think Stephanie laid out very well, these are very strong designs. They have a long-lasting impact, and where you can use them, we should be. So one of the things that we've done for years now is we've put priority in National Institute of Justice solicitations. We put priority on randomized evaluation designs where possible. Okay, So we'll have a solicitation. We'll say, you know, priority will be given to randomized applications. My own candid assessment on that is that it hasn't yielded a high number of randomized controlled trials that actually get to the funding point of funding. And that's because it's very challenging for a researcher out there to unilaterally put a randomized controlled trial into place in an applied setting. And so it's very expensive, it's very difficult, and our timelines, even if we give you 60 days to put that application together, that's extremely difficult to do. So we do get a number of applications. A lot of them don't make it through the very competitive review process. What we're trying to do to up the number of randomized controlled trials that we actually field is, I think, demonstrated in this one solicitation that I've listed here, the evaluation of the multi-site demonstration field experiment, what works in reentry. This closes tomorrow, so if you haven't seen it, you know, you got about 24 hours to put your... No. So it does close tomorrow, but this solicitation, even if you're not applying for it, you might want to take a quick look at it. It represents a deliberate effort on our part to work across NIJ and BJA to structure a field experiment out of the gate. So it allows us to address some of those challenges that we heard about in terms of, you know, being able to put a program together with distinct exposure to avoid contamination, to foster and nurture that randomization process. It's so hard to really keep true in the field. So we have a great deal of commitment to this, and our goal is to really put a series of randomized controlled trials in place so that at any given year we've got a number of them at different stages of development coming out of National Institute of Justice. But I want to take a big step back for a second. Because when we went around our organization and started talking to people about evidence-based practice and evidence-based programs, we started hearing different things from folks in terms of what their priorities were. And it sort of informed our goals. Well, one priority is we need to do better research. We need to do more research. Another priority is we need to really get that information into the hands of the practitioners in a way they can use them. But then there was this other priority about synthesizing and integrating information and evidence that was very important to people. We do a lot of work that's cross-cutting for our organization. So we've got a juvenile justice office. We've got a BJA is sort of our criminal justice office. We've got a victims office. And we've got a, you know, NIJ, the research and evaluation arm, and BJS, the statistics arm. In that sense, it makes us very well situated for addressing these questions of evidence. But frankly, we have cross-cutting issues where we're not all working off the same base of knowledge. Same things happening out in the field. So we needed to step back and look at some basic definitions. And now we are Department of Justice. I mean, at any time we can go ahead and call up the National Academy of Sciences and get some of the best minds from across the country or even internationally to noodle on these questions. We didn't do that. Instead, what we really try to do is say, well, let's come up with some working definitions that really seem to make sense and could relate to our audience, our constituents. And so we came up with one for evidence. Evidence is information about an object or question that's generated through systematic data collection, research, or program evaluation using accepted scientific methods that are documented and replicable. Okay, it's still a little wordy. But the key pieces in there are systematic, it's documented, it's replicable, it's accepted scientific methods. Okay, so it doesn't say anything about whether the evidence is actually accurate, right? We're taking our cues a little bit from the way evidence is used in the rest of the field of justice. It's not a foreign term to us, right? We've got prosecutors, attorneys, investigators all over work with evidence all the time. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Evidence has different levels of reliability. DNA evidence might be very strong evidence, but we don't say, well, you know, we're only going to look at DNA evidence. We're not going to throw eyewitness evidence out the door completely just because we know there's biases and errors. Okay, so we use evidence of different qualities to make life or death decisions every day all across our country, and we look at it on a case-by-case basis. Similarly, that's how we feel evidence should be treated in this domain. But we break it out a little bit. So causal evidence is really what we've been talking about when we're talking about effectiveness. Getting to effectiveness, causal evidence provides information about the relationship between activities and interventions, and activities or interventions and intended outcomes. So this is basically program evaluation. Cause and effect, X leads to Y. We distinguish that from what we call descriptive evidence. Maybe that's not the best name. But we're basically saying there's a whole other world of information out there that's collected through valid statistical or scientific methods and of varying qualities, but that characterize individuals, groups, events, or processes. They may use quantitative or they may use qualitative research methods. Now, I'll tell you a little of my background on this. For 9 years, I was the gang program coordinator for the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Now, if you really want to understand some things about gangs, you'd probably do well by looking at some of that qualitative research. There's been some great qualitative research on gangs that tells us about group processes and how the internal dynamics of those gangs play out. It doesn't tell us whether this program will or will not be effective, but it tells us some important information. But how do we incorporate that into our conversations about evidence? So we've got another term that we're working with that we talk about, actionable evidence. Okay? At what point do you have actionable evidence? Now, this is a very basic definition. It's of sufficient quantity or quality to influence the decision-making regarding a practice or policy. Okay? But now we're talking about something different. And this comes back to me in terms of the types of issues that we face at the Office of Justice Programs that people around the country are facing. Every once in a while, actually fairly regularly, we have people come to us from a city somewhere in the country or a county. And they say, and it's the mayor and it's the chief of police, they're coming to Washington to meet with a number of people, but they want to meet with us. And they say, we've got a bad problem and we need to figure out some ways to address it. And the problems that they come up with are things that are usually pretty general. And they're going to get into a problem-solving kind of mode. And it's rarely going to be something along the lines of, what I'm looking for is a list of programs that I can pick from and just simply replicate. Okay? That's going to be a piece of it. That may be a piece of it. But they're usually thinking about multiple strategies. They might think about things that, what are we going to do in the law enforcement? What are we going to do at the schools? Because we're dealing with youth violence, and that's a tricky issue. Okay, we've got truants. We've got kids that we're worried about who are deep into this. And we've got kids who are worried about that are on the way. And we know there's stuff going on in the family. Okay, what do we have to say to these people? And if we're just looking for randomized controlled trial evidence, then the answer is we're probably not going to have a whole lot to say to them. Okay? But there's so much more that we have. And in order for this field, I think, to really take steps forward, in addition to focusing on those highest rigor studies, I think what we need to be focusing on as well is how can we use the wider range of evidence to help these folks. So there are a number of factors that would probably be considered in terms of thinking about, well, whether is this evidence actionable? Obviously, the method design. What design do you have? What kind of findings are you getting from what kind of designs? The rigor of the particular study, right? You can do a poor RCT. You can do a poorly executed randomized controlled trial. Or you can do a well-executed one. The point we heard that I think Ed McGarrell was just making. Consistent results across multiple studies of different methods in different places by different investigators. So this question of multiple methods, we know that each method you're going to use has its own limitations inherent. But as you get multiple methods of different kinds pointing in the same direction, you have a level of increased confidence. At what point does that confidence tip to the point where I'm willing to make a decision on that? Well, that might depend a lot on the importance and the size of the decision, right? Going outside of criminal and juvenile justice field, when we look at public health, we haven't seen, and I stole this line, but I think it's so good it's worth stealing. I'll credit David Altshuler. But we haven't seen a randomized controlled trial that says that smoking causes cancer or that it's bad for you, right? There are some things that we don't, for any number of reasons, conduct RCTs, but we know at this point that that's the result we're seeing. So there's a level, there's an accumulation of actionable evidence. On a smaller issue, you might be willing to make a move, a decision locally based on a smaller piece of information. So I want to give you a sense for how we can get to actionable evidence, because it speaks a little bit to this question of, you know, we talk about how do we evaluate and how do we test the effectiveness of any particular programs. But I think what a lot of folks are also looking for is, what should we develop in the first place? And whenever they were doing that deterrence work, whenever they were working up those different approaches to dealing with gun violence or any of these pieces, they were using information. They were using evidence at the outset to begin to develop those designs in the first place. And we've got to be in that game, and that game has to include, that game has to be recognized as part of the evidence-based work that we do. So one of the things we're doing out of the evidence integration initiative in our organization is we're testing out this idea of developing integration teams, evidence integration teams, that are really going to draw together personnel and resources from across the Office of Justice Programs to delve into the evidence and really synthesize the evidence and try to articulate principles for practice and programs and policies. This is not an enterprise that is entirely new. We've had any number of efforts to review the literature and make suggestions. One of the things we're doing here is also for the purpose of developing an understanding and an ability to use evidence within our own personnel and staff in the Office of Justice Programs. Because if they're going to have any effect in being able to communicate that, the importance of that effort and the findings of that kind of effort to the constituencies that they serve, they need to understand it themselves a little bit. So we're not just working with our researchers, we're not just working with our PhDs, although we have a fair number of them. We have brought together program and policy people from across Office of Justice Programs to focus in on some target areas and dive into the research a little bit. And so they're going to look at some specific topics and start drawing together the evidence base. I want to give you an example of this actionable evidence, what I think is actionable evidence based on a synthesis of existing, in this case, descriptive evidence. Okay, so again, I'm my background, I've done a lot of work on gangs, and this was something that we published out of the U.S. Attorney Bulletin in 2006. This is a graphic that was included in a chapter that I wrote. And essentially what this graphic does is convey an accumulation or a synthesis of descriptive evidence in a way that informs practice and policy. And I'll go through it pretty quickly here. So the vertical axis is the share of illegal activity increasing as it goes up. Horizontal axis is relative share of the population. And what we're trying to talk about now is addressing gang problems within a community. Okay, so we start from the understanding that we're talking about a community that has a significant amount of gang activity. And what we do is we present this general graphic to show that in those communities, you have a small portion of people at the top of this triangle, the group number one, small proportion of people who are involved in a lot of the serious violent offending. Okay, this comes from research that's been replicated in many cities. And the one that comes to my mind is out of Orange County, California. 8% of all of their offenders were responsible for over 50% of all of their serious violent offenses. Okay, so that's one group that's out there in your community. Below them, you've got another group that includes a larger number of active gang members and associates. Okay, again, whole body of research that gets into this question of, once you enter a gang, your likelihood to offend, violent offending, property offending, weapons, drugs offending, all of that goes up. Okay, we know that from longitudinal research. We know that from qualitative research. We know it from survey and interview research with gang members themselves. Okay, and we know that they're not all up in that top group. Okay, so they're out there committing offenses. Third group you've got is a high-risk group. Again, we get this from the longitudinal work. We get it from survey work. And it's the younger kids, and we know when they come to the attention of the system. They usually start coming to the attention of the system 8, 9, 10 years old. They start showing up with some delinquent acts, and they're high risk. We know what those risk factors are, and we know how risk factors work now. Okay, again, all descriptive evidence. And it tells us something about this group of young people who are going to be part of from which the next cohort of gang members is most likely to come, but not all of whom will go into the gang. Finally, at the bottom of the triangle, you've got everyone else who lives in that community. It's the general population. They don't offend a whole lot, and they're a much larger group. So why is this actionable? Because all of those groups track or correlate directly with specific types of anti-gang strategies. Okay? So when I published this article in 2006, it was to the U.S. attorney audience, and they had a vested interest in trying to understand gang prevention and how it relates to their overall efforts because they're a little more enforcement-oriented. We started getting invitations, come out and speak to us. I've spoken all over the country about this diagram, which is nothing more than a bunch of descriptive evidence synthesized into one sort of digestible graphic that puts together the relationship between different anti-gang strategies. I've had people go beyond where I've said and say, well, really, this also speaks to how we should put our investments as well. So I don't think that's quite exactly correct, but I think there's something there because you've got to put a lot of energy into that top group. But what it also says is, how do you put together a multi-strategy anti-gang program within your community in a way that's going to hit on all the people who are really involved? So this is a way that I think we should also be looking at evidence, that I think most of the discussion really isn't going in this direction right now. We're going to try to see how far we can go with this, because I think this also puts puts social science researchers in an important role within the field. The more we can start talking about actionable evidence, the work that we can do to help develop programs and help develop them through these building blocks, if you will, as Ed put it, this building block model of building evidence towards effectiveness. So with that, I'll leave it, and we'll open up for questions. Thank you very much.